Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing the potential return of former President Peter Mutharika to contest in the forthcoming 2025 Malawi presidential elections. I'm joined by a very special guest, Dr. Henry Chigaipe. Dr. Chigaipe is a political scientist and currently the director of the Institute for Public Policy Research and Social Empowerment, based in the capital of Malawi, Lilongwe. You have to correct me if I'm pronouncing this wrongly. Henry, I'm very delighted to have you join me today. And, barring the few technical difficulties we experienced joining in, I do look forward to a very exciting conversation.
Great. Thank you, Michael, and thank you for having me on this program. Just to make a small correction, I live the name of the institution is Institute for Policy Research and Social Empowerment. Policy Research and Social Empowerment. And I am also the president of the Political Science Association in Malawi.
Oh, brilliant, brilliant. Sorry, you're even more important to this conversation. So thank you about that correction. I take that. But so Malawi is looking to go into another election next year. And there's a potential return of the former president, Peter Mutharika, has declared his intention to run, you know, under the opposition party, the Democratic Progressive Party. Before I get to him, there seems to be a pattern that we're seeing across, not just in Africa, but we've seen in the neighboring South Africa, Jacob Zuma is also returning. We've seen in America, Donald Trump. So we see these men are in their 80s or if not. How can you see, is this, and then it says Senegal will see a young president. How can you look at this? Is this a global dynamic? Is the era of old leaders coming in? Or what do you think?
Well, it is indeed an interesting pattern that we are beginning to see. I think in the beginning, we thought these are isolated episodes, but they are happening perhaps too frequently. And they are also happening in quite a number of places, even in places that you have not mentioned. So there is now convergence of perception that perhaps this is an emerging pattern, and we do need to start engaging with this pattern. And perhaps this is the whole reason why there is now some kind of an old discourse that is being given a new lease of life. In terms of putting a cap on the upper age limit when someone can actually run for president. Everyone is saying that the most difficult job in any country now is actually being the president of that country. And if people are asked to retire at the age of 65 or 70 or thereabouts, why should it be acceptable that people should be coming back in their 80s to do the most strenuous, most demanding job in that country or perhaps in the world? So there is some kind of a contradiction that we are seeing. And people are saying, if we have a floor, the minimum age when you can become a president, and in this country it's 35, there is obviously an upper limit beyond which you can't become president. In fact, in normal jobs that are less stressful, less demanding than being a president of a republic, people are asked to retire at 60. I think the judges will retire at 70. And we're beginning to see people who are tired, who have seen the best of their time, they have made the best of their contribution already, at least in so far as the theory of age is concerned. And we're beginning to see them come back. And we are beginning to rationalize and justify that on the basis that there is wisdom in old age. I think we do need to begin to interrogate this scenario because if you look at the case of Jacob Zuma in South Africa, if you look at the case of Donald Trump in the US, and even if you look at the emerging case in Malawi, what is common to all these three is a leader who feels has unfinished business. In fact, it is his cause he would like to settle with those that he contest against him and sort of pushed him out of power. So there is much more than we are seeing, at least in these cases, we see unfinished political business and intentions to settle scores. I think the issue is, you will see when I get back this power, I will use it to deal with you. It's that kind of thing that we are beginning to see. But I think that our systems, in the way they function so far, they really do not support people at those advanced ages coming back to actually take the most strenuous job in the country. It is an anomaly that is quickly becoming a normalized pattern. But let's see. And let's engage with it, and let's see what it means for democracy and what it will bring on the table.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. The contradiction in terms of whereas in other field you see, I like the analogy you made. If there's a minimum age limit, there should also be a maximum age limits where you can come to this. So before we move forward, I was going to say, you mentioned unfinished business, which we've seen certain scores, but these people also, their comeback, they ride on the wave of populism. They ride on the wave of, so I wanted you to see how they're able to combine their personal drive with this populist agenda or populist ride on the narrative of people discontentment and all of that. How do you explain that?
Well, again, maybe a drawing from the three cases we've been speaking about. If you look at the case of South Africa, South Africa has really been in some kind of a deep shit for some time now, particularly in the energy sector, in the transport sector, and so on. And most of what we've seen in the recent years about South Africa's economy sort of unraveling are basically long-term effects of things that happened in the past, and probably during the time when Jacob Zuma was president himself. So the impact is coming back now. And the person who has to bear the brunt of that impact is the person who is the president now. And so he becomes unpopular for being unable to deal with a gigantic problem that was created by people who are actually rooting for his ousting from office. So again, there is a paradox there. It's the same pattern We see the case in Malawi. Peter Mutharika did not want to leave office. The story is out there. It was bitterly contested at the ballot booth, but also in the courts. And even after the courts had ruled, he went on to contest and sort of speak ill about the courts and so on. So this is someone who didn't want to leave power, but had to leave power anyway. So he would do anything to come back. And he will ride on a wave of populism because people are and will always be discontented with how the government is responding to their public policy problems at that particular point in time. But when you look at the causation of the key fundamental problems that raise these discontents, their causation is not in the immediate past. It is in the distant past. It's built up over time, and it built up over a period of time when the people currently running the government were actually in the opposition. So again, we see this. If you look at the United States, we've watched the politics, we've seen it at play. He had an agenda that he wanted to complete. He couldn't complete it within 4 years because of the system of checks and balances that caused gridlock on some of his proposals and so on. He lost the election. He believes he was pushed out. He contested, he'd been in courts and so on. So the pattern seems to be repeating itself. And I think what this suggests is that we need to start rethinking the kind of incentives the term limits have brought in the equation of political leadership. Why Trump wants to come back is because he believes under the Constitution he still has one term to complete his go at the presidency. It's the same thing here. The president believes there was one term of his presidency robbed and he wants it back. It's almost saying, I am entitled to it. I was elected to my first term, and so people expect that they will go on to their second term. And when they leave at the end of the first term, it's like they haven't completely enjoyed their right to be president of the country and so on. So they would like to come back at some stage. And I think there is an incentive that has developed over time that in countries where you have term limits, once you are elected for your first term, it is almost assumed, taken for granted, that you will move on to your second term and that others should wait and so on. And when people can't wait and they push you out, you think they have wronged you and you want to come back. And believe you me, when you come back, I don't think you'll be ruling in the interest of the nation. I think you have a scores to settle against certain people and so on. And I think this is what we'll see in the US if Donald Trump comes back. This is what we will see in South Africa. If the MK gains in popularity and acquires significant numbers of seats to be called to form government or to become another opposition bloc in parliament. So there are specific context-specific dynamics and variables that are shaping what's happening in different countries. But as political scientists, we are interested in trying to see what is common to the cases that can help us to, develop a framework that will enable people to understand what's happening.
Before we address the elephant in the room, I was going to, come to that in terms of the system that allows this to happen and, and tread democracy itself. What I feel like democracy to me is not healthy. At the current way democracy is, even here in the UK where we're based, we see where elections are being called all over the world, even in developed countries where democracy seems to be under some sort of, it's under some threats, if we can use that word for better, lack of better word to use. But I wanted to you to comment on something before we talk about that. So if we look at, come on to those three cases. So we see Jacob Zuma in South Africa is facing some corruption charges and courts in Donald Trump. Donald Trump was facing the same. In Malawi, what is the legacy of Peter Mutharika? And is he, or has he faced any similar stuff? And what has he, so legacy in terms of the economy, you mentioned something very important that when we're talking about populism and how these people contribute to the poor economy, the same economy that they want to come and save, but you know, they contribute to. So what is his legacy?
Well, I think there is quite a lot that can be said about Peter Mutharika's legacy. Some of it good, some of it bad. But I think maybe it's good to begin with what looks good. And I think that when we look at the period he was president for like 6 years. But I think his most effective years were the five, because the sixth year is the one that you continue because another one has not yet been sworn in, but your mandate has run out. When I look at his time in office, which is from 2014 all through to 2019, what you see during that period is some kind of macroeconomic stability. So the macroeconomic fundamentals, things such as inflation, things such as exchange rates, and so on. He had an economic team that was good at managing those variables. Probably because they had a minister of finance who had done many, many years in IMF and was director for Africa in IMF, and so had a very good idea of how to manage those macroeconomic fundamentals in a dependent economy, in a fast globalizing capitalist economy. You look at the currency stability, low levels of inflation. When they came in, the inflation was very high. They were able to bring it down and they kept it low and so on. Of course, there have been stories arising, but it was all artificial. They were manipulating figures and stuff like that, you know. But the fact remains that the currency was stable or more stable than it is. Inflation was low. The lending rates at the bank, the interest rates were reasonably low. Here in this country, the rates are very high. They have never been low. You can't compare them to any banking system in the developed world. But they were stable during that period. Okay. And these are the issues that are different now. The current government will tell you that it was all artificial. There is a case, people were arrested at the central bank, taken to court for falsifying data, misleading IMF, and so on and so forth. For the ordinary man on the streets in the village, they didn't feel as much price shocks as they have felt during this time arising from inflation as well as currency devaluation. That is really where the issue is, because with that, you have prices of fuel going up and you know it has a ripple effect, then the prices of everything goes up and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And we are a largely importing economy. And so these things have real direct effects on the economy and the livelihoods in terms of what the majority of people in the informal economy can actually afford to do. So life has become tough for a majority of people because of movements in these macroeconomic fundamentals. And to repeat, they were fairly stable during Peter Mutharika's presidency. But perhaps that's really the good part about it. Everything else, to the extent that I can see about his presidency, I think certain things become worse. Corruption became worse because other than just, you know, in this country, we speak of democracy, democratizing corruption, making corruption accessible to everyone, you know. So it's been very inclusive. But during his term, it took an additional dimension of nepotism and so on. And when we review public finance management during that period, we see a lot of schemes, very innovative schemes for, you know, taking money from the public sphere and privatizing it through all sorts of really things that... that shouldn't have happened. So I think on many other areas, the performance was very dismal, barely keeping the government together and going, and benefiting a small group of people, their associates in business, in politics, and so on, including putting on a government payroll people who don't work for the government, but are supporters of the party. They are cheerleaders of the party, and so on and so forth. So you get all sorts of these things associated with the executive arrogance and the impunity. So that's the dark side of his legacy. But, you know, no man is 100% fine. No man is 100% evil. So he had his strengths. He had his weaknesses. So it's a sort of a mixed legacy. But I think in the current discourse, why he is hitting waves, populist as they may be, it's really because of how he and his economic team were able to manage the macroeconomic fundamentals and keep them fairly stable, and they avoid the ripple effects through the pricing mechanism, which I think is something that has been a bit of a challenge for the current administration. But on the other things, we just move from one worse off situation to another worse off situation.
This reminds me of Nigeria in the 80s. So Nigeria had a president that was a funded of a military president, and he was somehow embraced by the West. And even though he was a military ruler, not, he was embraced because of he was doing some macroeconomic reforms, taking some IMF, this, he was able. And then, but one striking resemblance to what you've just described was this term offensive, the way he was able to democratize corruption. So they call him the Maradona of Africa.
Corruption.
Because he made corruption. So everybody is happy. So everybody. So when you mentioned that, it just reminded me of that time. So they say, oh, even though he's corruptible, at least everybody has part of the pie, no matter how little. So, but we're looking at Malawi. Malawi's has been relying heavily on foreign aid. In terms of, I think I'm looking at Malawi seems to be the least economically developed country in sub-Saharan Africa. So it's developed relying on I don't know for now, but you know, I've read in some places where that has been said. So these reforms that Mutharika was performing, was it in a way externally influenced? Because in places like Uganda, for instance, you see where Museveni, you know, even though Museveni is authoritarian to the people, but he's been seen in the West as, you know, because of the economic, macroeconomic reforms that he was performing, the magic was performing with. But again, these people rely on external stuff. So I'm looking, was there a point where, you know, those reforms are being externally driven, and like Riley said, you know, whether it was manipulated or doctored or not, the fact still remains that there was low level inflation. There was the exchange rate was, you know, whatever. But one, so that is one was externally driven. But the key question is democracy. And that is where my current research lies now. When you talk about democracy that is allowing corruption to be, is allowing nepotism, is allowing. So are we practicing the right system? Should we start, is it the system? Is the problem the structure? Is it the system? Is it the kind of democracy that is being practiced? So I think that's the key question. Is this a challenge to our adoption of liberal democracy? If I can frame it that way.
Right. Two questions there. Let me begin with the first one. Were the reforms homegrown or externally driven? Being an aid-dependent, loan-driven economy, the level of influence of the World Bank and of the IMF is very, very great. In fact, in some spaces, we joke about the macroeconomic policies, the monetary policy of the Reserve Bank of Malawi being just an extension of the IMF wing. Okay, the macroeconomic reforms are very, very heavily driven externally by the IMF and by the World Bank because of the structural vulnerabilities that our country has. Being a landlocked country, we not producing enough for sale outside this country. The trade balance is in our disfavor, so we are importing more than we can export, and so all those things put together make us vulnerable and a very good candidate for IMF treatment. And so that also gives the IMF and others a lot of sway, power, and influence on what our economic policy is going to be, particularly when it comes to macroeconomic management. So that is what it is. And I think until we figure out how to produce more, sell more, become a more self-reliant economy and so on, it will take a bit of time before we can begin to shed off external influence in the space of economic policy. Is it the system? Is it democracy? Well, the performance of African democracy in terms of socioeconomic transformation and development is very worrying. And I don't think that the problem is the democracy. My view is that the problem is in how we have managed the interface between neoliberal economic policy framework and the political framework with the democratic ethos. So the way we have brought these two together and the way they interact and shape outcomes, I think that is where the problem actually lies. You see, look at China, Michael. Look at China. The way China has developed at the moment is that you have a very capitalist China when it comes to managing the economy and economic activities, and a very socialist China when it comes to the politics. Okay. You look at countries like Rwanda. Okay. It is in the political arena a very suboptimal democracy. But when you look at what they are doing in the economy, you see that their economic framework is very capitalist, but it's managed. It's managed to stem off the excesses of a neoliberal economic policy framework that do not fit in their context, given their level of development and so on. So you come to a country like Malawi, we went full swing liberal democracy on the political side and full swing neoliberal economic policy on the economic side. Put those two together, you are not an economy that has enough absorbent capacity to deal with the shocks that these extreme positions in terms of how power is configured and exercised and how the economy is managed can actually work together. And this tends to be the case in many African countries. The interface between the politics and the neoliberal economic policy framework. In countries that have done wholesale adoptions of these frameworks without adaptations and modifications and contextualization, they tend to be worse off in terms of the outcomes. So you get people complaining. And because people can't directly complain about neoliberal economic policy, they just complain about political leaderships and democracy. Because they believe in the primacy of politics, that the politics and the politicians will sort out the economy. And I think our African politicians must begin to understand that, that from the eyes of the people, the primary expectation is that they will use political power to sort out the economy. And when you come to the frameworks that we have adopted, you find that almost politics and economics are expected to be running parallel without the use of political power to manage certain macroeconomic fundamentals and so on. People are expecting the state to make sure goods and services are produced, but you have an economic policy framework that says the state has no role in the economy. How do you reconcile that?
Listen, this is the first time I've seen someone clearly draw the distinction. This is a brilliant way of describing this dilemma. And I think the way you've simplified it, if people can see clearly, I think that could be a roadmap to where we might go, where the future should naturally lead to. But if we come to like the people themselves, so we've seen that in Africa we have a growing youth population. And it's one where I don't know, to say, to some extent, this population is becoming very enlightened with globalization and access to internet, and they see what's going on but in some other places as well. We can see that this population as well is a lot maybe misinformed or doesn't have the collective power to challenge some of these things. Thank you for tuning in for this week's exciting episode on the potential return of former President Peter Mutharika of Malawi. Join me to thank our guest, Dr. Henry Chigaipe, for his very deep and useful insight. Unfortunately, we lost Dr. Chigaipe due to some technical issues, but I hope you've enjoyed the conversation so far as much as I did. I implore you to stay tuned for more episodes, and until next week, see you.